open your Bibles to Habakkuk chapter 2 this evening. Habakkuk chapter 2. We came down to verse 4 last week in Habakkuk chapter 2, and I decided to stop there because beginning in verse 5 and on down, we're going to have a series of woes that are going to be uttered against Babylon. And because of that, does anybody need a set of notes? They're not really notes, they're question and answer sheets. Oh. So I still had a few of those left. Anybody want to say? Habakkuk chapter 2. And we're going to put in at verse 5 tonight. Where we left off, it's just to kind of lay the background so everybody kind of remembers what's happening in Habakkuk. Habakkuk begins with Habakkuk having what he calls, and if New American Standard calls it an oracle, but it's really a burden, such as some of your older Bibles translate it. It's a burden because it's a weight that he bears in this terms of a prophecy. So it's not an oracle. That's not a good translation of what he's talking about here. And Habakkuk sees all the violence and the injustice going on in his nation. And very grieved by that, he cries out for God, how long are you going to do this? How long do I have to look at that? And God answers him back by saying, well, I'm going to send Babylon against your people. And Babylon are really vicious, tough, hard, cruel people. And Habakkuk is taken aback, thinking, wait a second, I'm seeing violence here, and you're going to bring in even more violent people upon them to punish them? And Habakkuk's wrestling with this now in his mind. And as he's trying to understand this, we ended then last week with probably the most noted verse here out of the book of Habakkuk. It is the most noted verse, but it's a very commonly quoted verse in the New Testament. Most people don't, I think, even realize that it's from Habakkuk that says, behold, for the proud one, his soul is not right within him. The proud ones, they just think everything's going to be fine. They're arrogant against this. But it is the righteous one that will live by his faith. And as we said, live, meaning literally, he's going to go on physically living in the same way that you and I live in our Christian lives by faith. That brings us to verse 5. It says, furthermore, wine betrays the haughty man. A different word. We had pride, the proud one in verse 4, the first part. Now we have a person that's haughty, a person that's arrogant in this crime. And it says, wine betrays the haughty man so that he does not stay at home. He enlarges his appetite like Sheol. Now Sheol, remember, is the place where the dead went at death. Some of your real modern translations, such as the NIV, they don't translate this Sheol. They try to translate it the grave, but this is broader than the grave. This is actually a location that everybody went to during the time of the Old Testament. It says Sheol, its appetite is like Sheol. He is like death, never satisfied. He also gathers to himself all nations and collects to himself all peoples. What he gets at when he says here at the beginning of verse 5, furthermore, wine betrays this haughty man. Is this person in his arrogance? It's as though he has drunk his wine to this place that his senses aren't right, and he goes off and makes choices and engages in activity that if he was sensible, he wouldn't do. But this person being, this person acting without real senses in this, because of, as he says, because of the wine and his haughtiness, this person has this huge appetite like Sheol. It just keeps collecting more and more nations, more and more peoples. We could illustrate this to death, but the illustration that comes to mind that I always think of in this regard, it's kind of like a country like ours right now that looks and we've got problems, and there's a certain group of people in our country that think, well, the solution to our problems is to tax certain groups of people more. And so take more away to help out other people, and that'll fix the problem. And this is their solution. And that's where these people are. You go, oh, just go out and get more people. Well, that's not enough. Go get more people. Go conquer more people. And if you're really sensible, you'd say, just going and getting more all the time, does getting more solve the problem. Because they have this, really what it ends up being is you have this unquenchable appetite, like Sheol. And the reason you say Sheol has an unquenchable appetite, is there anybody in the Old Testament that escapes death? Elijah and Enoch, two out of millions that escape death. Everybody else, they die. In fact, it's been true since Christ died too. Everybody since Christ died, except for the people that are living right now, have all died. No exceptions. Sheol, and granted you and I don't go to Sheol, but we're talking from an Old Testament perspective, everybody dies. And Sheol, so it's looked at, Sheol has this unquenchable appetite. More people, more people, more people. And he says, that's the same type of situation that you have going on here. Just unquenchable appetite. So therefore, he comes to verse 6. Will not all these, now what are these? These is going back into verse 5 where it says, at the end of verse 5, he gathers to himself all nations and collects to himself all people. That's the these. It's all the people that the nation is going out and taking and capturing and just keep getting more and more and more. It says, will not all these take up a taunt song against him? Okay? We all understand what a taunting song is. Kids did these, you know, when you were a kid, other kids, when they were picking on a kid, you know, then they do a taunting song, and stuff like that. That kind of thing. That's what it's talking about. It's a taunting song. And he says, the people that have been captured are going to take up the taunting song. Now, why are they going to do that? It says they're even going to go on to mockery and insinuations against him. So he's going to draw now, beginning here in verse 6 now, five woes. I think we all understand what a woe is. Woe is them. Something bad's happening. First one. He says, woe to him who increases what is not his. For how long he makes himself rich with loans. Now, you stop and think about that. A person could continue to, I've known of people that looked like they were doing really well, nice vehicles, everything's fine, they've got the best of everything, and you're going, wow, how do they do that? Only to find out, oh, this actually happened with an individual that I'd actually visited with the person. I didn't know them real close, but I knew somebody that had the firsthand relationship with them that ended up getting involved in this, trying to help them figure out how to solve their problem. They had, at that time, somewhere over $90,000 of credit card debt. Over $90,000. Because they'd used credit cards to put their kids to send the kids to Bible college, to send their kids to Christian school, to buy vehicles, everything. Everything was on credit cards. So, you increase, it says here, what's this statement that he makes here? He says, you make yourself rich with loans. Now, here's the question. Was Babylon taking out loans? Well, all depends on how you look at it, because it goes on. Will not your creditors rise up suddenly, and those who collect from you awaken? So in other words, yes, if you take out loans, eventually your creditors are going to want to be paid back, and eventually you're going to be in trouble when you can't pay back. And so he says in the middle of the verse, indeed, you will become plunder for them because, and here it is. Now, this is how they took out loans. Because you have looted many nations. See, God's looking at it as every time Babylon conquered another people and took from those people what those people had, it is just a matter of time until those people are going to come and take it back. Or until they have to pay up for stealing and looting and taking from other nations. You can only do that for so long, and eventually it comes back against you. And so this is what he's looking, in other words, the creditors and the loans are what they've taken by violence. We're going to see this kind of picture come up several times through here. So verse 8, because you have looted many nations, all the remainder of the peoples will loot you. See, you've been plundered, or you've looted them. Now they're going to plunder or loot you. Because of human bloodshed and violence done to the land, to the town, and all its inhabitants. Babylon enriched itself at the expense of the people they conquered. And it was only a matter of time until those people rose up against them. Now, we can kind of see the tables on this. Just all we have to do is step back in history a little bit further here. It wasn't that many years earlier that Babylon had been under the Assyrians. And what had the Assyrians done? Assyrians had done the same thing. They had enriched themselves at the expense of the people they conquered. And eventually, the Babylonians and the Persians became incensed at having to always owe these guys something and always be under the hand of the Assyrians. And they went and besieged Nineveh and then besieged Haran. And eventually, as we said, eventually besieged the city of Carchemish, which is where the whole battle turned. And that's where it failed. And it's from the Battle of Carchemish that the Babylonians now are going to come down and they're going to come against Israel. And that's the time frame where this is at. So they should be able to look at it themselves and say, look, we have been enriched. We went and collected on the debt owed us. And now they're going to do the same thing. Same thing's going to happen to them. Okay. So woe number one, you've gotten rich essentially by stealing. He calls it taking out loans. He's looking at it as a metaphor. Now we come to verse 9. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to put his nest on high, to be delivered from the hand of calamity. Now, this verse in the New American Standard says, woe to him who gets evil gain for his house. And the word gain that he uses here, that word gain occurs twice in the Hebrew text, back to back. He gets gain. And then he calls it evil on top of it. Calamitous gain. But that word gain is literally, it's a word meaning to cut. It was used from a chunk of fabric that a weaver in a loom would be weaving fabric, and then they come along and they say, now we got a piece of material big enough, and they hack that material off and send it off. There it is, it was cut off. So the word ended up being used of cutting off other people. It was used of getting gain by taking a cut. So it's always, one of the ways people picture it when you do the word study on this is it was like taking extortion. Yeah, you can have it, but you're going to have to pay us some money every month to make sure you get to keep doing what you're doing. And so that's what he means by they're getting gain, but it's gain by cutting. So there's two parts of it. There's two ways of looking at it. Gain by either getting a cut from them or gain by cutting someone off in the process. Both are ways, both of this word for gain was used in both ways. Taking a cut from people as well as cutting people off to get gain. And Babylon did both. A lot of times these countries would get conquered, and then every year, essentially, the country they conquered would have to pay a tribute to them. What's a tribute? You can call it what you want. You call it a tax even if you wanted to, but in reality, it was an extortion cut that, you don't do this, our army's showing up at your door. It's kind of like the mob saying, you pay your monthly bill, or my enforcers are going to show up and break your windows or your kneecaps. This is what they're doing. So he says, you do this, in other words, you get this gain, you build your house to put a nest on high. So it's looking at birds putting the nest on high so that they can be delivered from the hand of, New American Standard says, the hand of calamity, but it's the same word that's translated evil in the first part of the verse. So it's that. When you understand that evil, it's calamity. You're trying to deliver yourself from the hand of calamity, but you're doing calamity to get the gain to do that. Which he goes on to say, you have devised a shameful thing for your house by cutting off different word than the word that's used back in verse 9 from cutting, but I believe this is where he shows you part of what he's talking about with the getting gain by cutting off. Because he says here, by cutting off many peoples, so you are sinning against yourself. Surely the stone will cry out from the wall, and the rafter will answer it from the framework. if you get gain and you build something for yourself, but you do it at the expense of others, because you've had to either cut people off or you've stolen or taken a cut from them, then it's like every time you'd look around at your gain, it would be as if Gary built this house here by cheating a whole bunch of people, then Gary'd look it over here and there'd be this wall, this rock, would be nagging him. He'd be sitting in the chair every night, and that rock would be saying, Gary, you did it dishonestly. You did it dishonestly. You know? Well, that's what he's saying. Or the rafters cry out. In other words, every time you're going to look around, it's going to be a reminder. You have this because you cut somebody else off. You got this because you came by it in a dishonest fashion. Okay. So that's the picture that he's using here. This person living in this house, and they got it by dishonest means at the expense of others. So woe to them. Now, the interesting thing when he says woe to them, here the woe is, they're living with this guilt. They've got this guilt, this sense of guilt all the time that they've done this. The woe in the first time is the creditors, the people that you owe, are going to rise up against you and want their payment. Now we come to woe number three, beginning in verse 12. Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and founds a town with violence. Again, something the Babylonians were doing. They were taking advantage of other people. They killed a lot of people. There was a tremendous amount of violence, and they used it to build cities. But woe to them who did that. Is it not indeed from the Lord of hosts that peoples toil for fire? Now, this is kind of one of those expressions in here that what he's trying to say is when people are brought into a situation of judgment, ultimately it's God that's going to use them, and God's going to cause this. God's going to be the one that's going to cause them to toil in this way, toil for fire. Toiling for fire in this case, meaning you build the city, and it's just going to burn. All your works, all your efforts, everything you put into it, it all burns. So here, we're these Babylonians. We take from these people. We use it to build up our place, to build up our house, to build up our city. And then back in the land, it all goes up in judgment. So this is what he's looking at. And eventually, remember, the city of Babylon would eventually fall. And it says, and nations grow weary for nothing. How long can you put a nation to the task of laboring for you without eventually them having a rebellion? They're not going to weary themselves for nothing. Eventually, it'll come to something. For the earth will be filled eventually. This is talking about one in the future then. With the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. In other words, God is going to bring the fire. He's going to bring the judgment on you eventually. In fact, there's a day coming in which God's judgment will be so thorough that the knowledge of who God is will be everywhere. Now, this was not going to happen during the time of Babylon. This was not going to be taking place back then in those days. This is looking out in the future that ultimately God's going to bring his judgment on these people out in the future. The book of Jeremiah in chapter 31, where it talks about God establishing the new covenant, one of the things it says in connection with the new covenant there, it says with the new covenant, it said that that you will no longer teach every man his neighbor saying, know the Lord. It says, for they shall all know me from the least of them to the greatest of them. Now that's at the beginning of the kingdom. And so at the beginning of the kingdom, everybody was going to know the Lord. There wasn't going to be an exception. Because remember, there are no unsaved people that go into the kingdom. They're all believers at that time. And so again, this helps us to see that as he's leveling these woes against Babylon, he's looking at it both in terms of Babylon that was right there, Babylon across the Mesopotamia, over in Mesopotamia, across the desert off to the east, but it's also looking ultimately to the Babylon that will exist in the future. We're going to see a little bit more of this here in just a little while. But you clearly see that when he talks about God bringing judgment on these people, God's the one that causes people to toil for fire. All the work, it's all burned up then, it comes to nothing. That you see that that's tied ultimately in the future to there being knowledge of the Lord everywhere. So that means it can't, it's just, we're trying to say, it can't have been at that time, because God did not cause the knowledge of him to be over the whole face of the earth like the waters cover the sea. So it's future. Then we come to woe number 4, verse 15. Woe to you who make your neighbors drink, who mix in your venom even to make them drunk, so as to look on their nakedness. And the word to look is here is not the normal word ra'ah, but it's the word I've got to look at you. It's probably not going to make any difference to you, but I'm trying to remember what the word is here. And it's navat. Kept wanting to say God, and I knew it wasn't God. It was navat, which has the idea of to look at with interest, to look at a thing with the idea of paying attention. Now, in the Old Testament, you have this expression several times listed throughout the early parts of the Bible, especially when God gives them the law, that you shall not look at your father's nakedness, you shall not look at your mother's nakedness or your sister's nakedness, and so on and so forth. And he's not talking literally about seeing something. He's talking, it's a metaphor, it's a euphemism for physical relationship. Now, it's interesting, I've noticed more recent word studies on this go, no, this was just looking at. But that's not. You can go back and you can look at those texts. I went through a bunch of them in studying this, and they're clearly in the context they're talking about actually engaging in a physical act. The looking at is not a sin. The looking at is not a problem. Well, I'm not saying it's okay to go around looking like that, but you get the point that it's... The actual looking is not what he's talking about. He's talking about, and this really with this verb here, to look at with intent. And then it's in the Hebrew, it's in an infinitive showing the very purpose of doing this. There's a very purpose. Getting this person drunk purposely, we would really say, to take advantage of them.
It's the same word as with Noah and his son. His son looked upon his nakedness.
It's not the same word for look, but it's the nakedness is the same thing over there. It's a different Hebrew word that's used over there for the looking in that case that he uses. And again, that's one of those things where, again, looking at modern commentaries, they look at it and they say he was just going in and saw something. That's all he did was see. And it wasn't just that he saw. In fact, one of the things you find out in the case with Noah is it wasn't just Ham. There's Ham's son Canaan, because remember, Canaan gets the curse along with Ham. Why does Noah specifically curse Canaan? Because Canaan apparently participated in whatever went on. And Canaan is the father of the people of the land of Israel that were engaged in the gross immorality for which God kicked them out of the land. Okay? So you can see that what went on. Okay? So when he's talking about this, he's not talking about a matter of modesty or immodesty in this case. He's talking about people, to put it in a modern scenario, it would be like a person getting somebody else drunk to take advantage of them. Okay? Which I think you all understand what I'm saying. We'll leave it at that. Verse 13. Is it not indeed the Lord of hosts? Or no, I'm going back to the wrong verse. Verse 16. You will be filled then with disgrace rather than honor. And this idea of disgrace here is literally that which is shameful. In other words, you are going to be shamed. Now, one of the things that God did in punishment for different peoples, and it's one of the things that happened at times that God punished Israel with, was that when they were conquered, the people that would conquer them would strip the clothes off of all the people and make the people march to their new location naked. Because you feel really vulnerable. Quite frankly, I don't know if any of you ever had those kind of dreams when you were a kid, but I'd have those dreams once in a while where I'd be walking down the street in town, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, there are any clothes on. And the thing wasn't a dream. It scares the daylight out of you because you feel vulnerable. You feel like you can't protect yourself.
How about the San Francisco thing going on
there? I'm not even sure what that is.
It's not against the law in San Francisco to be naked. So they're having a contest to try to get in the Guinness Book of Records.
Oh, Lord.
To see how many Santa Clauses they could have. Or something.
Okay.
Only in San Francisco.
Yeah. Okay.
We don't live there.
And this is going on today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know? Mankind hasn't changed much.
No.
It's interesting that during World War II, with the way the Jews were treated in Germany, that was also one of the things that they did frequently, was that they'd strip the Jews down and they'd make them march naked for miles and miles like that to disgrace them. So this is what he's talking now about what's going to happen to Babylon. This is a euphemism. He's not saying literally that Babylon came over and got people drunk and then literally sexually took advantage of them. But he's picturing the way they took advantage of people, that it's like somebody doing that. Like somebody getting them drunk to do this. And so he says, you're going to be covered with shame. In other words, in the same way that people were stripped and made to march, he says, something like that is going to happen to you. You're going to be covered with disgrace, or literally be shamed. Now you yourself drink. Expose your own nakedness. The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you. And utter disgrace, again this idea of being shamed, that will be on your glory. So in other words, the thing that would have been your glory, the thing that would have been your weight or your significance, is actually going to in the end become the thing that is your very shame. You're going to be put that your shame is going to eclipse anything that might have been seen weighty or valuable with you. And then, with that, well, I'm just going to turn to it in this Bible. We're going to save those for the end. I'm sorry, I wanted to save those for the end, and then we'll kind of go over and compare some of these. Verse 17 then, it says, for violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, and the devastation of its beasts by which you terrified them, because of human bloodshed and violence done to the land, to the town and all its inhabitants. Now, verse 17 kind of delineates a little bit how they took advantage of these people. They went to Lebanon. One of the things, Lebanon was known for its cedars. It was known for cedars that they were, even in Old Testament times, cedars that were being logged off to be used in ships, in masts and ships and things such as that. The temple, remember, was built with a lot of cedar beams and different cedar boards that were brought down. And remember, up north there, that Solomon made arrangements with Hiram, king of Tyre, for this material to be brought down, and had workers. So these things were done. Well, the Babylonians came in, and the Babylonians, essentially, to continue using the terminology that God's using here, essentially went in and raped the land. They went in and just destroyed forests, taking all this wood for themselves. And not only did that, but essentially just went in and just hunted creatures for sport till there wasn't anything left. And that's what he says, and they did that in Lebanon. We use that terminology, or environmentalists use that terminology today, say raping the land, but that's exactly what God's saying Babylonians did with the land there. They just took everything and left. Well, you got bare hills and there's no wildlife left, and they just take it all. And so he says, it's for this then that they were going to come under a woe. Verse 18. What profit then is the idol when its maker has carved it? Or an image, a teacher of falsehood? For its maker trusts in his own handiwork when he fashions speechless idols. So you think of idols. You could make an idol that really looked very human, could look like a fish, could look like a dog, all the different things that they made idols to look like. And yet then you go up and talk to that, and it doesn't talk back to you. Do you see those things there? Yeah. You see that, Aaron? If you went up and talked to that, is that thing going to talk back to you?
No.
Because it's a statue.
If you touch it, you might hear a voice. Oh.
How old are you? You're six. Okay. See? Now notice this. Stop and think about it. A six-year-old realizes you go and talk to something that's carved, even if it looks human and looks kind of cool, it's not really going to talk to you. Not in the sense that if you ask it a question that it's going to answer you back. And yet that is exactly what God is saying here. Thank you, Aaron, for your help. That is exactly what God is saying through Habakkuk here, is you guys fashion these speechless idols. You make these things. They can't talk to you. And so he says in verse 19, woe to them who says to a piece of wood, wake up! You ever tell a piece of wood to wake up?
No.
No. Sounds pretty silly, doesn't it? Or to a stone, and it calls it a dumb stone, and we use dumb in a different way. This dumb means it can't talk. Okay, so Gary's got this is made out of stone. Would you walk up and talk to that? Say, talk to me! Talk to me! Would you expect it to talk to you? No. So to a dumb stone, arise. This is my teacher.
No.
What would you do if you walked into class tomorrow? And instead of Mrs. Phillips, there was a stone up in the front. And everybody said, this is going to be your teacher today. You'd think that's pretty silly, pretty foolish. But he says, but that's what they were doing. Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver. Okay, so let's take a piece of wood or a stone and let's cover it with silver or gold. Does that make it better now? Is it going to talk to you better? No, you cover it with silver or gold, still not going to talk to you. See? Because there's no breath at all inside it. If you listen careful, do you hear this breathing? I can't hear it breathe because there's no breath in it. Are those things breathing? Are they breathing? No, because they're not alive. And this is what God is saying to them. He says, woe to you people that do this. Because the Babylonians worshipped things that they carved. They talked to them. They prayed to these things. They asked them, tell us what to do. But he says to them in verse 20, but the Lord, that's God now, but the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. Now he says, the Lord's in his holy temple. Point is, instead of going and talking to a piece of wood or a rock, they could go and talk to God. They could have come to God at his temple. Now, that tells us that at this time, the glory of God hadn't left the temple yet. The glory of God is going to leave the temple in the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel, just a little while after this, is going to actually see a vision. He's going to be on the other side of the desert over near Babylon. And he's going to see a vision in which he's going to see the glory of God leave the Ark of the Covenant, go to the door of the temple, and from the door of the temple go out onto the hill, and then go away. But while this was being written, they could still go and talk to God. In fact, Isaiah said, seek the Lord while he may be found. They still had a time, when Isaiah was right, they still had time to go and seek God. He was still around. They could go and find him. But it wasn't going to last much longer. Pretty soon, and there'd be judgment, and it would be over, and they wouldn't be able to look for God anymore. So, there are five woes here. There is a woe in verse 6 to the one who enlarges himself, makes himself bigger, enriches himself by what is not his. There is a woe beginning in verse 9 about one who gets unjust gain or gets gain by cutting others off. There's a woe beginning in verse 12 about a one who builds a city by blood. That is, he kills people to accomplish something. He has to kill to maintain or increase his greatness. There's a woe in verse 15 about one who gets his neighbor drunk so as to take advantage of him, to take something from him that he's not entitled to. And there's a woe in verse 19 to one who calls out to speechless idols, idols that can't talk. Five woes that he speaks against the Babylonians. If you want those, we'll go over those again when we're done. Now, I wanted to take a look at a couple of New Testament passages that are going to relate to this Babylon in the future. Because we were talking a little bit about this Babylon and what has happened. So I want you to take your Bibles and turn to the book of Revelation and turn to chapter 18. Now, I believe these woes are in large part literally fulfilled with regard to the city of Babylon back then. But remember, there's also a Babylon that will exist in the future. So the first one I want to look at is in verse 18, or chapter 18, excuse me. When it talks about builds a city by blood, one of the things that's been necessary when for this Babylon to exist and to accomplish her purpose is that she's, you have to have something that you're against. You have to, so it's almost like if you really want to be a good political power in the world, you have to have an enemy. People always like to have something that they're watching out for where they can say, we're the good guys and they're the bad guys. And it really gives you something to rally around. Let's go back to World War II. Hitler was really good at this. Hitler could have just come in and tried to come to power. But you know what? Really, in reality, from strictly a twisted human point of view, he was really smart in the way he did it. He found an enemy that they could all be opposed to. Now, I'm not saying it was the right thing to do. I'm just saying he picked an enemy. And he made people an enemy. People that in reality weren't an enemy, but he made him an enemy. And as a result, he got a lot of support. There were a lot of people that were behind them. So it's, if we can take care of these Jews, we'll fix some of our problem. And we have to conquer these other countries around us that really need to be brought under our control and our protection because we can run them better. And that's the kind of thing that you do if you want to be successful in the world. You've got to conquer other nations. It's happened all throughout history. Okay? So, this Babylon has done that same type of thing. And one of the passages, we've looked at this before, is verse 24 of Revelation 18. And it says, and in her was found the blood of the prophets and of the saints and of all who have been slain on the earth. Now here's a question. This Babylon he's talking about, are they responsible for everybody that's ever died ever? Is that what he's trying to say? No. If you put it in the context here, it's all those who have died with regard to a religious conflict. Have there been Christians that have died because they went off to Vietnam and fought in the Vietnam War and got shot? Yeah. Were they fighting Babylon? There might be some people that would say so, but I don't think they were fighting Babylon. How about the Korean War? How about World War I or World War II? How about the Civil War? In other words, in all those, were those battles against this Babylon? No. But have there been many Christians in the history of the world that have been killed for religious purposes? And that's what this Babylon is doing. And that's what it actually happens, is this Babylon subsumes all religion underneath, under its guise. And it combines religion and life and commerce. And it brings it all together. And politics. And it binds it all together. And it opposes those people that will not become a part of it. And it kills them. And that's what this city has done. And it's built itself up by doing this. And it's going to continue. And especially in the future, when this real Babylon comes to power again in the future, this is really going to be the case. This city really will go back to seriously, significantly murdering believers. Now, they won't be Christians at that time because it's going to be a different situation. But they will be believers. They will be real believers. Let's take a look at another one. Turn to Revelation chapter 16. Revelation chapter 16. Revelation chapter 16, and if you look at look with me at verse 17. It says, and the seventh angel poured out his bowl upon the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple from the throne saying, it is done. And there were flashes of lightning and thunders and peals of thunder. And there was a great earthquake such as there not been since there came to be since man came to be on the earth. So great an earthquake was it and mighty. And the great city was split into three parts, the cities of the nations. And Babylon the Great was remembered before God to give her the cup of wine of his fierce wrath. Now this is this picture that we had over in when we were over there in Habakkuk, that they had made people drunk to take advantage of them, but they're going to turn around and get God's wrath in return. And so he looks here that God has remembered them to give them the cup of wine of his fierce wrath. Still, I've got a 14 here, but it's obviously not the right 14. And I don't know. Let me go back just a second. Okay, well, we'll just pass over that because I'm not exactly for sure what I meant by that verse. But turn down to chapter 17 in here in the same regard. And in chapter 17 and verse 5, first of all, it says, "And upon her forehead there was a name was written of mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots." And harlots meaning, remember, that she has prostituted herself by engaging herself with all these other peoples, all these other religions, everything. Nothing's been off limits. Except maybe, shall we say, real biblical relationship to God always is unacceptable. "And of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman," now notice, "the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered greatly at her." Now, what does he mean when he says she's drunk with the blood of saints and drunk with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus? It's that this idea of exercising this power and of killing these people has actually had the effect of causing her to be drunk. You've heard talk the expression being drunk with power. That's what's happening here, which really was kind of the way even some of this went back early when we looked at verse 5, where it was talking about that wine, it says, deceives or leads a man astray. And he was using there the metaphor of a person getting drunk with wine for people making really bad, non-discerning choices. And he goes on here, over into chapter 18, and it says in verse 1, "And after these things I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority. The earth was illumined with his glory. And he cried out with a mighty voice, 'Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She's become a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean spirit and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality. And the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality.'" In other words, in the same way that she got them drunk to take advantage, as we saw in Habakkuk, in the same way it shows here, these kings have drunk. They've drunk well, and they have been engaged. The very thing that she did, exercising all these violence against the people of God, all the nations have gotten involved in it. She's gotten them drunk with all of this. And I believe that goes back and informs us a little bit on what Habakkuk did when it said that you have gotten them drunk to take advantage of them. And by doing that, you've got them wrapped up and involved in the very same thing that's your problem. And they get wrapped up in it, of course, in the process you're taking advantage of them, which is somewhat what this city Babylon is going to do, because the kings of the earth that get drunk with her one moment turn around and actually eat her and devour her later because they don't like the way she's taking advantage of them. But what you're seeing is them parallels. You're seeing this parallelism between what's going on in God's five woes of judgment against Babylon over there in Habakkuk and God's judgment of this city Babylon in the future. And the relevance in Habakkuk was specifically for Habakkuk's generation. In Revelation, the relevance is partly for those people that will be living in the future, but it's also relevance for us. Because we saw when we started this in Revelation, at the end of Revelation 18, that in her was the blood of the prophets and the saints. And there was, back up in verse 20 even of Revelation 18, it says, "Rejoice over, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, because God has pronounced judgment for you against her." Why does he say apostles? See, because when this is being written, the apostles are reading it. because this city, the authority of this city and what it was doing was affecting the apostles even at the time of the New Testament. And so this has relevance for you and I to appreciate God's judgment, because maybe we're experiencing this. I shared during prayer requests about all those believers that were killed over there in Africa that Rob had told about. And they were killed because they're believers over there. Because they're believers. And they're under a system that's opposed to them being Christians. So you had about 100 of them that were killed in September, about another 45 killed here, or 40-some killed here at the end of November. And it's this system that even the church has to deal with and is affected by, not the Babylon that's over there in Iraq, but the Babylon that is really, in reality, already kind of exercising some power to a limited degree, bearing some influence, weaving itself into politics and commerce even now, mixing religion and all these together. Even that is still a system that's post. And I think it's been that way through the history of the church. It was existence back then. It's only going to grow in influence during the church's time. But eventually, when the church is not here and you move out into tribulation period, it's going to really increase in influence. And so in the same way that God pronounced woes for that city in the Old Testament, it should be an encouragement for us that God really has pronounced woes here in the book of Revelation, really, ultimately, against that city. Because you and I get hit by it. We get affected by it. Okay. Any questions? No other questions? Okay. Well, let's close in with a word of prayer. Father, we are thankful for the fact that you tell us what our future is, and you tell us even about what the future of that religious, commercial, political entity that is only going to increase in its authority, but is even in opposition to you and to your people at this present time. And it encourages us in the same way that Habakkuk in his day could live by faith, by realizing what you were ultimately going to do to the even more violent people you were going to use to punish your violent people, Israel. That as he looked at that, he was able to live by faith and be encouraged. We in that same way are able to live by faith in the fact that you will accomplish through us your purpose, and that you will indeed bring, as Paul says to us, as he writes the Thessalonians, you will bring upon them a righteous judgment for what they have done. So help us to appreciate and understand what it is that you have planned, not only for us, but planned also for those that are opposed to you. And we thank you for it, then. Amen.
So the king of Babylon, I mean, the...